Sean Patrick Nord, where do you think you're going?
Me and the boys are going to go down to get ossified at the pub.
What pub?
Grandma, there's only one pub in town. The Rusty Nail.
The Rusty Nail? That pub is the reason why your granddad is not here today.
Grandma, I've heard your tetanus joke before.
Do you remember the last thing your granddad said before keeling over from Lockjaw?
No, Grandma, what did he say?
He looked me straight in the eye and said, "The one thing I do regret in my life is ever setting foot in the Rusty Nail."
Lockjaw. Your grandma probably told you you were going to get this if you stepped on a nail. And what was she talking about? It was tetanus. Now, we don't see tetanus that much in the Western world anymore, but in developing nations, it still accounts for a lot of mortality and morbidity, including in neonates. So what exactly is it? Tetanus comes from a clostridial species, Clostridial tetani, and just like another clostridial species, botulism, which inhibits the release of acetylcholine, tetanus inhibits the release of glycine and GABA, and these are inhibitory neurotransmitters. And the end result is the classic opisthotonus that people get, and ultimately they die from a respiratory arrest. So what is opisthotonus? Opisthotonus is the severe arching of the back. And why does this occur? This occurs because the extensor muscles of the back are much stronger than the flexors. Just imagine all of those muscles are firing at the same time and the back muscles win. And this isn't subtle. You hear these people across the emergency department. They're screaming in pain. It's very dramatic if you've never seen it. They are literally arching their back like a McDonald's arch off the bed. And anytime you see this, you have to say, could this be tetanus? Yes. But could this be strychnine poisoning? Because strychnine poisoning inhibits the binding of glycine in the spinal cord and looks exactly the same. So you have to say, is this tetanus or is this strychnine?
So just to summarize, Sean, you just told us about two major life-threatening ER presentations, both involving clostridial species. And it's really actually easy to remember, right? Acetylcholine inhibition makes you stop. You can't move. You're a floppy baby. You're a paralyzed adult that can't hold your head up.
You're a Hollywood D-list celebrity whose smiley face looks just like frowny face.
Right, that's botulism. And then we have tetanus, which you said is a blockage of the inhibitory neurotransmitters, glycine and GABA. And so then you have a go. They're firing all their neurons. They're twitching all their muscles and they're in this spasm. So Clostridium botulism is a stop and Clostridium tetanus is a go, right?
That's exactly the way of thinking of it. They're on opposite sides of the spectrum.
Okay, perfect. But we're not actually going to talk about the acute patient with opisthotonus today, right? We're going to talk about the prophylaxis and prevention of tetanus.
Correct. Our very own Rob Orman is going to be talking with Ron, a resident at the Oregon Health Sciences University, about the prevention of tetanus with tetanus vaccination and tetanus immunoglobulin.
Think you know tetanus shots? I thought I did, but I was incorrect. So let's get down to the cold, hard tetanus facts. Do tetanus shots work?
This is Ron, the OHSU resident.
Tetanus vaccination absolutely works. It was first introduced in World War I, where before its introduction, about 3 in 100 battle case wounded soldiers would actually get clinical tetanus. That was a very high number.
And we're not seeing 3% of our patients getting tetanus.
Not anywhere close. Basically, after its introduction, they noted a 30-fold decrease in the incidence of tetanus within 2 months. So it was basically happening only one case out of 1,000 battlefield wounded soldiers. In the civilian world, it was introduced in the 1940s as part of the routine childhood vaccination series. And ever since then, the rate of tetanus has also dropped 30-fold in the civilian population.
You get a 30-fold benefit protection.
There was 600 cases in 1940, and now there's only 20 in 2009.
So how effective is a single tetanus shot? And we don't just get a single tetanus shot when we get our childhood vaccines. You get a second. You get a whole series of tetanus shots.
Yeah, so that's a really important distinction, the distinction between the primary series and the booster. So the primary series is what educates your immune system to begin with to recognize a tetanus as a pathogen. Since then, you get a tetanus booster every 10 years for the rest of your life. And its efficacy between the different doses, it's hard to say exactly what it is. It hasn't really been studied. But when the CDC looked at this when it came out with the recommendations, they show that if you followed and adhere to this regimen, you have basically 100% of the people that adhere to this regimen pretty much have antibody titers in the protective level.
That is the childhood vaccines,
mm-hmm.
and then a booster every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
and that is 100% effective antibody titer. But can people who have had the vaccines and have the appropriate titer still get tetanus?
Absolutely. So titer level alone...
That does not bring me comfort.
It doesn't bring any of us comfort, but it is a way of life. Titer level alone is only one piece of the puzzle when you're talking about developing clinical disease. You have to counterweigh that with the disease burden, so the amount of pathogen in the blood, your own immune system, how well loculated that pathogen is away from the rest of the circulatory system. It's a really complicated microenvironment.
So that's the idea of if you have a clean wound, you need it every 10 years. But if it's a dirty wound, you should have a 5-year booster.
Kind of. This is where it gets also very complicated. So when you look at the review put out by the CDC of all tetanus cases between 2001 to 2008, 70% of wounds were indeed what we would consider tetanus-prone wounds, dirty wounds, puncture wounds. But 30% of them, and that's not an insignificant number, are actually clean wounds. There's actually reports of wounds from surgeries with autoclaved instruments that actually produce tetanus.
When does the immunity start to wane? Say you get your shots, then you get a booster at 11, and then you get, usually people get one before they go to college in the United States and Canada. At what point do you go into that ineffective level? Or are you going to stay at 100% immunity if you keep up with that every 10 years?
Age will cause everyone's immune system to wane. When you look at the series of actual tetanus cases, in the US, there has been no neonatal tetanus cases. And for people under 20 years of age, there's only one or two cases in those last 8 years that it was documented. But age, for everybody, the immune system gets a little bit weaker, it gets a little bit more senile, it forgets. And so the booster is even more important for older individuals. But having said that, tetanus is also a very unique pathogen. Unlike any other pathogen, getting clinical tetanus and recovering from it doesn't actually convey immunity, because the tetanus toxoid is one of the most potent toxins known to man. The lethal dose is 2.5 nanograms per kilo. It's at a level where your immune system wouldn't even recognize it, even if your body was facing disease. And so keeping up a kind of a super therapeutic level of antibody titers is important for protection, which is why the boosters are important. And it's even more important with age. The other factors like diabetes, HIV, other immunocompromised states induced by drugs like prednisone can obviously also make your immune system weaker and more liable to forget about the tetanus toxoid.
Now here's the money shot. The tetanus toxoid booster, the tetanus shot after stepping on a nail. I mean, that is the classic. So let's make it a case that we can all relate to. You're working at your local ER or urgent care and you get a call. It's Friday, it's 6 p.m. A 30-year-old electrician stepped on a rusty nail and it poked into his foot.
What did I tell you about the rusty nail?
He had all of his childhood immunizations, including some boosters before he went to college, and he wants to know if he needs to get a tetanus shot tonight, or can it wait till Monday when he can get in to see his primary care doctor? What do you tell him? Because he's uninsured, this is going to be a significant difference in cost, because if he needs to come into the emergency department late at night, it's going to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. If he goes sees his primary care doctor, it's going to be a lot cheaper.
So the most important thing, even if we're talking about tetanus, is to irrigate the wound with a lot of water and to debride any necrotic tissue. And so this patient, presuming this patient can do that alone at home, the question is, the one thing he can't do at home is give himself the tetanus vaccine. So what is the relative importance of tetanus vaccination after the fact to an exposure? So we already talked at length at how the tetanus vaccination is terrific as primary prevention, so happening before the fact to an exposure. Tetanus vaccine probably doesn't do very much as secondary prevention. It's not very helpful after the fact to an exposure. So there's actually a study done by Porter, and it was published in Vaccine in 1992. They had 31 adults who received the tetanus vaccination, and they measured the antibody titers at day 0 and at day 4, because clinical tetanus can develop by day 3, and they show no significant change statistically or clinically in the titer levels. And so having said that, because clinical disease can develop within 3 days, and local tetanus develop even before that, the tetanus vaccination probably adds very little to secondary prevention. But what I tell this patient is, even though we give tetanus vaccination like water, in truth it doesn't do very much after the fact to the exposure. The most important thing for this patient to do is to irrigate and debride.
So for the secondary prevention, there is a certain degree of futility in giving the tetanus toxoid. And if he's not up to date, then shouldn't he come into the emergency department to get a dose of tetanus immune globulin because he's not up to date and he is at risk for tetanus?
In the States, that is not the case. The States does have its own criteria for the use of tetanus immunoglobulin that's actually different from the rest of the world. The CDC's recommendation is that you give tetanus immunoglobulin under two conditions, both of which should be met. Number one, that this is a wound that is anything but clean and simple. So his wound actually qualifies as something that's not clean and simple, being a puncture wound. But the second criteria is that this patient has to have an incomplete primary series, less than 3 doses of the tetanus vaccine. This patient, even though he's not up to date with the boosters, he did have his primary series. So he is okay to be without tetanus immunoglobulin. The rest of the world does it a little bit different. They try and estimate the risk of tetanus through the characteristics of the wound itself. So for example, in the UK, they would give tetanus immunoglobulin irrespective of the immunization history if the patient is tetanus prone and is at high risk. Tetanus prone wounds are wounds that are puncture wounds, wounds with foreign bodies, wounds with significant devitalized tissues, or wounds with burns and sepsis. And high risk is any wound that is also at risk of heavy contamination with fecal material or soil or material that is likely to contain tetanus spores. The US doesn't really use this criteria because its rate of tetanus is actually very, very low. And as we talked about before, 30% of wounds seen in the States are not from what we would consider tetanus prone wounds.
If this guy was in the UK and he was not up to date on his tetanus immunization, he would get tetanus immunoglobulin.
He might. This is under interpretation from the provider at how high of a risk this nail puncture wound was for actual tetanus spores. If it was in an area, say a rural area where there's a lot of feces or soil or manure or cow droppings, kind of the reservoir for tetanus, he probably would. But if it's not, if it's in a very urban environment, you might not get it.
Going back to something you said, what about someone, and we'll go back North America here, what about someone who has never had a tetanus vaccine or doesn't remember if they've ever had one? In our area, we have a large population of immigrants from Central America, and many of them tell me that they have never had a tetanus shot, and they get a cut, and what do you do?
It's all about what question you ask and how you ask it. Because I think the most frequent question we do ask is, when was your last tetanus shot? And very few people can remember that answer. In fact, more than half of the people cannot remember that answer. And out of the other half that can remember that answer, the ones that think they are up to date, about a third of them are actually not up to date. And the ones that say they are up to date, about a quarter of them are not up to date. If you're trying to determine if a booster should be given, and you're giving it based on the recall status, about 40% of our patients will get the wrong treatment. This is why I hate asking that question. This is why I think that question is not very useful, because number one, giving the tetanus vaccine after the fact is of questionable utility. And number two, nobody can remember exactly when they had that in the first place. The more important question to ask is whether they had received their primary series. So what I would ask is, first of all, were you born in North America? And second of all, did you receive vaccines as a child? And if the answer, especially to I'm not born in North America, is a no, what I often have done is I'd actually Google their home country to try and figure out if tetanus is given as part of their routine childhood vaccination. And if they know they got vaccines from their home country as a child, and their country does offer tetanus vaccinations, then I presume that they had received the primary series.
Well, say they didn't. There's uncertainty, or the answer is definitely no.
And if the answer is definitely no, then this patient needs tetanus immunoglobulin.
And then after that, do they have to get a full tetanus series such as a child would get?
Exactly. In fact, you would give the tetanus immunoglobulin in one arm, and you would give the tetanus vaccine in the other arm. Then you'd ask them to follow up with their primary care provider to finish the primary series.
Going back to the guy we talked about before who stepped on a nail, wasn't sure about his tetanus shot, it seems like it's almost a matter of style, what you do with that. In one way, when you give the tetanus shot, the tetanus toxoid, it's a race against the clock to develop immunity. And tetanus can develop within 3 days, but it can also develop in a week and also can develop in several weeks. Maybe you say, yeah, come in and get it because we'll get you ahead of the game. I think that there's different approaches to that based on that same information.
Well, in your case, this patient had a primary care provider, can definitely see the primary care provider by Monday, so basically in 2 or 3 days. For this patient, it's not unreasonable to say, these are the options. It would be great to have a shared decision-making talk. Tetanus is not a very common disease. and this is your risk, and these are your options. You know, you can get ahead of the game by 3 days if you came in right now, but the cost is significantly more. Whereas if you waited 3 days, you are behind 3 days on developing an immune response. But at the same time, you do save a lot more money because the tetanus vaccine itself is dirt cheap compared to an ER visit.
And what would you do if it were you? So you're calling me and you're asking for advice, and I say that. Would you come in tonight and get a tetanus shot, or would you wait a couple of days?
I'd probably just wait a couple of days. And it kind of depends on, I'm thinking like if I was 80 years old, I'd probably just come in. But I'm just thinking about my immune system right now, I'd feel pretty safe.
The booster shot comes in Tdap, T-D-A-P, the tetanus diphtheria pertussis, and TD, which is tetanus diphtheria. Ran, I am thoroughly confused as to who should get what when. It seems to me that a pertussis boost is a good idea. I actually got a tetanus shot a couple years ago when we had a pertussis epidemic because I wanted actually the pertussis. But I've seen that the elderly should only get TD, the tetanus diphtheria, and not Tdap. Am I wrong about this? I mean, what is going on here?
Currently, the CDC recommends that every 10 years, you should definitely get some sort of tetanus vaccination. And after 18, one of those doses should be switched for Tdap. So you have an additional booster against pertussis. With the exception of pregnant women, with every pregnancy, they should receive a Tdap. There's actually good studies looking at whether it's worthwhile to give people above the age 65 Tdap instead of TD, just so that they have additional protection against pertussis. And the cost benefits of this study is that it's probably not worthwhile from a cost perspective to do that versus TD, though if you did, you have a 25% reduction in the chances that an elderly person will get pertussis. So it's not going to hurt the elderly person per se, but it's just going to cost the healthcare system a bit more money. To give you a perspective on it, Tdap is about twice as expensive as TD. TD averages around $25 and Tdap is $50. Not a significant cost on an individual level.
So we don't see a lot of tetanus these days, but it still happens, right? Diabetics, IV drug users, and at least on the board exams, that seem to be the main victims. Is there a group of people who we would consider fully immunized that could still get tetanus?
I think the biggest predicting factor is that immunity does wane with age.
Meaning that if I got a shot right now, 45, versus a 70-year-old got a shot, that his immunity might wane faster than mine.
That is completely right. Yep. Most of the cases of clinical tetanus do happen in elderly people. And you mentioned diabetes and disorders of the immune system like HIV. Those obviously also contribute to weaker immune system that will put you at increased risk for tetanus. Having said that, Talon had a great series on almost 2,000 patients in the ED, and he actually went ahead and measured all of their immunoglobulin levels, and he showed that in everybody who said that they were up to date on their tetanus vaccination, still 5% of them had lower than what would be considered as immune levels of immunoglobulin. Compared to if you're not up to date, that number goes up to 15%. And also, if you look at that case series published by the CDC of everybody who's had tetanus from 2001 to 2008, about 12% of cases had completed their primary series, but most of them weren't up to date on their boosters. Out of everyone who was up to date on their boosters and had completed their primary series, 3% of them still had gotten tetanus. So it's still not perfect, and it's hard to predict exactly who's going to get it.
Before, we were talking about studies would suggest that if you get your childhood vaccine series and then you get your boosters every 10 years, that your antibody level should be 100% of the time at the effective level. But maybe that's not the case for everybody just based on extenuating circumstances, because it's going to include all populations and not everyone's going to have the perfect immune response.
That's exactly right. And there's even case studies that show a patient who had protective antibody levels prior to getting tetanus, still getting tetanus even while having protective antibody levels. So there's obviously a lot more going on than just the antibody level on its own.
You were talking about before going to the 1914 time period and the 1940s that tetanus went down 30-fold. It didn't go down infinity-fold.
Still with us. And that's the thing with this bug. I mean, this is a pathogen that's not going to get eradicated like smallpox or even polio, which is close, but not quite, because the reservoir is in the soil and we're never going to get rid of that.
Right. No herd immunity like chickenpox.
Tetanus is the only pathogen that we have a vaccine for that is infectious but not contagious. So you can't rely on your neighbors or washing your hands or staying away from other sick people to avoid getting this pathogen. Everybody has to get their own protection. and your only protection comes in the form of tetanus vaccinations and TIG.
Okay, that was great. Smart resident, by the way. I think I got that all. What would you have to add to that, Sean?
Couple of things. Remember open fractures. They are tetanus-prone wounds, too.
Well, and I guess while we're at it, the eye, too, right? You can get it from a corneal abrasion.
That's right. Corneal injury is another tetanus-prone wound.
And that's why you should never look directly into a rusty nail.
And don't forget about antibiotics. If you're worried about tetanus, metronidazole is the agent of choice, but you can also use penicillin.
Okay, fantastic. So I think we've covered most of the scenarios where you'd need to think about the diagnosis and what the prophylaxis should be. Why don't you just take us home with a nice, concise summary?
You have somebody with a tetanus-prone injury. You ask them about their primary vaccination status. If you're unsure and it's tetanus-prone injury, give them the tetanus immunoglobulin, and you also want to give them their Tdap to start their primary series. Because it also covers pertussis and there is the nationwide outbreak of pertussis, I'm very aggressive giving Tdap. Even if they need to start their primary series and it's not a tetanus-prone wound, very often I do that to get them on that rope.
Okay, thank you, Sean. I think I got it.
That was a great discussion. Thanks, Rob, and thanks, Ron.